This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and welcome to another edition of Did You Know?
This is Para Tolson. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience.
And this is Bob Martin, and I'm all dressed up for today's show.
Well, I wouldn't exactly call it being dressed up.
You're wearing red tennis shoes and red gloves with the fingers cut off, gold bib overalls, a plaid shirt, and a mop of hair, Bob.
It's not a mop of hair. It's a mane. Guess who I am?
You're an escapee from a circus.
Well, I'll give you a hint. Want to hear me roar?
Not particularly. And I have no idea where you might be headed dressed up like that.
Unless you're going to Let's Make a Deal.
I'm dressed up like a lion.
Why do you want to dress up like a lion?
Well, I went to the movies the other night, and they were showing a picture from MGM.
That still doesn't answer why you're dressed up.
Wait until you hear this. The picture opens with a lion roaring.
Leo the lion. That's the trademark for MGM and has been for years.
I know, and that's the problem. It's time for a new Leo. One that is hip. One that is with it. One that is today. When you walk down the street, do you see any lions that look like that?
Bob, you don't see any lions walking down the street.
A shame to be seen. Well, I won't be. Think of the publicity I'd get for a new picture. I'd lead, and the crowds would follow right into the movie theater. And I can roar better than the old Leo. Want to hear me?
Not right now. If people would follow you into one theater, how about the other theaters?
Oh, I'd go there, too.
So the people would follow you right back out again.
And would you sit through the entire show in each theater?
I'd watch maybe two or three times, but not over and over again.
So pretty soon you quit going and the theaters would be empty.
Well, nobody would want to sit through the same show over and over again and several times the same day.
Also, it means different movies at different theaters in different cities all at the same time.
How is that possible?
The old Leo does it. You see his at the beginning of every show, don't you?
Gee, I didn't think about that.
You still want to roar for us?
No, I wasn't really going to roar. I was in costume only to tell you about an idea that I had for today's show.
Gee, and what is that?
Well, we've always liked quizzes. So, how about telling some facts about a person and see if we can guess who's being described?
And you're dressed up like the first example?
Yep. I'm what started the feud between the Hatfields and the McCoys.
I can believe that. Who won?
I don't know. Neither side wanted me. So, it ended in a draw.
Good choice. Now, we'll start with some fun facts about a president and see if you can guess which president. In 1831, he lost his job as a store clerk. In 1832, he was demoted from captain to private in the militia. In 1833, he lost his first election to the Illinois legislature. In 1835, he went bankrupt. In 1838, he lost his bid for speaker of the state legislature. In 1849, he tried to get a job as a land officer, but was rejected. In 1856, he was considered for nomination as U.S. Vice President, but was rejected. In 1858, he lost the race for the U.S. Senate.
And that was just his public life. In addition, he was born into poverty, lost his home at age 7, went to work at age 8, lost his mother at age 9, lost his business partner at age 24, and spent most of his adult life paying back old debts. Yet, he served 3 terms in the state assembly, became a prominent lawyer, and served in the U.S. House of Representatives, and finally, at age 52, in 1860, he ran for President of the United States and won.
And became one of our great presidents, Abraham Lincoln.
We have another president for you to try to guess, and we'll start out by giving you a big hint. He was born in Virginia in 1790 and married Letitia Christian in 1813. She died of a stroke in 1842, and while married, they had 8 children.
He had become president in 1841 upon the death of the previous president.
And who was that?
Sorry, too much of a clue. We will tell you that there was a near constitutional crisis when he became president. You see, The Constitution stated that upon the death of the president, the vice president would assume his position and powers.
What's the problem? If the president dies, the vice president takes over.
Right. But does he become the president or simply carry out the duties of the president? A big argument ensued.
How did they settle it?
They didn't. The vice president took the oath of office again in his hotel room and simply stated, "I am the president." And Congress accepted it, and that has been the policy ever since.
Sort of like, it's easier to ask forgiveness than permission?
Moving on to the next part of his background.
Are you asking?
Nope, just doing it. A year and a half after his first wife died, he began thinking of taking a second wife. It was at this time that David Garner, representative from New York, began to introduce his daughter, Julia, to Washington society. The president noticed and was smitten.
But Daddy Gardner did not approve.
Just because he was 54 and she was 24?
Well, that did have something to do with it.
So, what did he do?
Just happened to be at the right place when tragedy struck. Seems that a new warship, the Princeton, was being shown off to dignitaries. And in February of 1844, the group included Representative Gardner and his daughter.
When you're showing off, guns make a big hit. And a big gun on the Princeton put on a really big show. That is, until the last time it was fired, because it exploded, killing 8 people, including the Secretary of State, the Secretary of the Navy, and Representative David Gardner.
Young Julia is devastated and collapses. The president rushes to her side, picks her up, and carries her back to the White House where he tries to console her. And his powers of consolation must have been pretty good, because without the objections of Papa Gardner, he talks Julia into marrying him 4 months later.
Did you know that the president and Julia went on to have 7 more children, making him the most prolific president to reside in the White House? Oh, he also annexed Texas.
And his name is...
Well, I don't know about the family stuff, but the dates give it away. It was John Tyler.
Indeed it was, John Tyler.
And what future president said? I am sorry to be informed that the wicked and foolish practice of profane cursing and swearing, a vice heretofore little known in any American army, is growing into fashion. I hope the officers will, by example, as well as influence, endeavor to check it. A vice so mean and low, without any temptation, that every man of sense and character detests and despises it.
You're darn tootin'.
He also said, observe good faith and justice toward all nations. Cultivate peace and harmony with all. And can it be that good policy does not equally enjoin it? It would be worthy of a free, enlightened, and at no distant period a great nation, to give to mankind the magnanimous and too novel example of a people always guided by an exalted justice and benevolence.
And who said that?
George Washington.
Here's a profile of another president. He was born on the border between the Carolinas, and while there was some dispute on which state he was born in, it's generally conceded it was South Carolina.
But he went to law school in Salisbury, and afterwards he traveled on horseback between the county seats of Salisbury, Charlotte, Lincolnton, and Morganton, practicing his profession.
He was also known as a scrapper and had quite a reputation as a fighter. But aristocratic young ladies from the plantations frightened him, and he disliked the airs of high society.
And he was a practical joker. Wait until you hear this one. One warm summer evening in Salisbury, a grand ball was being held at the Rowan Inn. High society was out in force. The walls were lined with chaperones keeping close eyes on the young couples as they whirled across the dance floor. Tables were spread with lavish foods. Off in one corner, by himself, not dancing, was our future president.
Then, just before midnight, 2 not-so-young ladies, gaudily dressed and their faces painted garishly, appeared at the door and presented their admittance cards. The music stopped, and all faces turned to the door to watch as the doorkeeper called for the ball manager. The admittance cards were genuine, and the manager asked where they had gotten them. They replied, smiling, that they had received them from the young man standing off by himself in the corner. And with that, They stepped to the middle of the room.
Mothers and fathers gathered their dainty daughters. Escorts hurried for wraps, and the ball suddenly became empty. None of the gentlemen approached the young man in the corner, nor did any of them indicate that they might know the ladies from, other circumstances. The future president offered his arms and escorted the two ladies out to the now empty street to their waiting carriage.
Didn't even take them by the buffet table? Well, what president wouldn't treat a lady to dinner? If they weren't treated properly, they might leave a trail of tears behind them.
It was Andrew Jackson.
Okay. I have one, and this one is going to be worth extra credit points.
That tough, is it?
No, not so much tough. It's just hard to guess.
Well, maybe I can help. Take the word hard. Change one letter and make it barred. Change another letter and make it bare. Then once more to make it base. Once more to make it ease. One last time to make it easy. There you are. Just 5 steps, and we've changed it from hard to easy. Go ahead, Bob.
Wow! That did make it easy. But it's still going to be tough to guess.
Then I guess Stanley.
Stanley? I haven't given the clues yet.
That makes it easier. You don't have facts getting in the way.
I've heard that somewhere.
Para, I don't think that's helping. Go on, Bob.
Okay. Here's the story. John Rowlands was born in Wales in 1841.
Bob, you just gave us his name. What's there to guess?
Well, you can guess his other name. He was born out of wedlock and raised mostly in an orphanage. At age 18, he came to the United States and landed in New Orleans. Shortly after he arrived, he was looking for a job and met a man outside of a store whose name was Henry Stanley.
Stanley! You see, I was right.
Wait a minute, Para. That was the store owner's name.
Wait until you see what happens next. When young Rowlands asked Mr. Stanley for a job, he phrased it like the British would, and he said, "Would you like a boy, sir?" The man did not have any children and had always wanted a son. Not only did Rowlands get a job, but he and Mr. Stanley became quite close, and he ended up taking the name Henry Stanley as his own.
So, I'm right again. Quiz over.
Bob, you gave both names.
Oh, I guess that does make it tougher to solve. Okay, you can guess what he said that made him famous.
And when does he say it?
Well, pretty quick now.
How quick?
Oh, just a little while.
Bob?
9 years. Don't worry, I'll tell it quick. In 1862, he joined the Confederate Army and fought at the Battle of Shiloh, where he was captured. Not wanting to spend a lot of time in a prisoner's camp, he became a galvanized Yankee and signed up to fight for the Union side. It wasn't long before he claimed he was very ill, and the Union Army released him. With nowhere to go and no way to get there, he joined the Union Navy and served as a recorder, which led to a try at journalism. Then, growing a bit bored with life in the Navy, in February of 1865, while in Massachusetts, he jumped ship to become a full-time journalist.
And what did he say that made him famous?
Nothing yet. That came 6 years later. He gained enough of a reputation that he was sent on a trek to Africa to search for...
Let me guess, Dr. David Livingstone.
One and the same. And he found him in November of 1871 in what is present-day Tanzania. And when he found him, he said...
Dr. Livingstone, I presume?
Said by Henry Stanley, just like I guessed. But did you know that he might not have actually said those words? That portion of Stanley's diary was torn out.
But it makes a great story.
Also making a great story was that Livingstone was lost and Stanley found him. Did you know that Livingstone was not actually lost? He was searching for the source of the Nile River.
And after their historic meeting, Stanley and Livingstone spent time together proving that Lake Tanganyika was not that source. And then, when Stanley left, Livingstone remained to continue his search. He died in present-day Zambia in March of 1873.
Did you know that Stanley's account of his exploits, and sometimes cruelly surrounding them, is considered to be the inspiration of Joseph Conrad's later work, Heart of Darkness?
I think it's time for some bell ringers. And some of them of the pun variety. I thought I saw an eye doctor on an island in Alaska. It turned out to be an optical illusion.
A rubber band gun was confiscated from an algebra class. It was a weapon of math disruption.
No matter how hard you may push a piece of paper, it's still stationary.
Time flies like an arrow. Fruit flies like a banana.
Atheism is a non-profit organization.
A midget fortune teller who escaped from prison was a small medium at large.
If you jumped off a bridge in Paris, you'd be insane.
A sign on the lawn of a drug rehab center said, "Keep off the grass."
A backward poet writes in verse.
Two silkworms had a race. They ended up in a tie.
Two hydrogen atoms meet. One says, "I've lost my electron." The other asks, "Are you sure?" "Absolutely," replied the first. "I'm positive." You can look that one up in your chemistry book later tonight.
Two Eskimos were paddling down the river in their canoe. It got to be very cold, so the Eskimos built a fire inside their canoe. Unsurprisingly, the craft immediately sunk, thus proving again, you can't have your kayak and eat it too.
A vulture gets on board an airliner carrying two dead raccoons. The stewardess stops him and says, "I'm sorry, sir, but you're only allowed one carry-on for a passenger."
Back in grade school, my teacher once wrote on a report card that I was depensilable.
Don't you mean dependable?
No.
No, you know, those kind of jokes are fun, but they sure are corny. I wonder why we call them that. Why some jokes are called corny?
I know the answer to that.
Are you giving away family secrets?
I don't have any secrets that I know about.
What about the corn?
Oh, that's no secret. During the late 19th and early 20th century, corn catalogs were some of the dullest reading around. So, to keep up interest, the editors used to put in silly jokes. They came to be called corn catalog humor, and finally, just corny.
Let's get back to our stories about famous people.
And I know the answer. It's Stanley.
Why do you think the answer is Stanley?
It worked for Para.
That's what makes us different.
She certainly is different from you, Bob. It's not Stanley. Only this man didn't become a president, but he did have a family honor to protect. When the hostilities broke out at Fort Sumter, he was a young man in Canton, Massachusetts, and heeded the call and enlisted.
His first duty assignment was with a regiment ordered to Ball's Bluff, which was a short way up the Potomac. They were to rid the area of rebel soldiers who were threatening the capital. He shouldered his rifle and off he went. Unfortunately, he and 700 men were captured by the Confederate troops, and he was marched off to prison in Richmond.
Then came an order from President Jefferson Davis that some of the men were to be executed in retaliation for the proposed hanging of a group of privateers that had attempted to run a northern shipping blockade. Our young man drew one of the short straws and was prepared to climb the scaffold.
Then a reprieve came in when Lincoln canceled the hanging of the privateers. So Davis canceled these hangings as well. Within weeks, the soldier was exchanged and returned to his old regiment.
He fought bravely at the Second Battle of Bull Run and Antietam and was finally sent to Gettysburg. After the first day of battle, he was helping the wounded on the battlefield when he was shot in the head and killed.
He had added to his family's reputation. He was Paul Joseph Revere, Jr., the grandson of Paul Revere.
And speaking of Fort Sumter...
Wait a minute. We weren't speaking of Fort Sumter.
Of where?
Fort Sumter.
You just said it. So, speaking of Fort Sumter, we have a couple of interesting facts about Fort Sumter and the beginning of the Civil War. Who was the president when the first shots were fired upon the fort?
That's simple. Abraham Lincoln.
Are you sure?
Of course. It happened on April 12, 1861.
But did you know that supplies were running short at the fort, and so the president ordered a ship to bring new supplies? The ship was the Star of the West. But not everyone was happy with this plan. The president's Secretary of State, John Floyd, was a Southern sympathizer, and he notified Confederate troops in South Carolina that the ship was coming. Cadets at the Citadel moved cannons onto the shoreline in preparation. When the Star of the West entered the harbor, the cadets opened fire and hit the supply ship three times. The ship retreated back into open water, and no supplies were delivered.
And that happened on April 12th.
No. That happened on January 9th, 2 months prior to to Lincoln taking office. The president was James Buchanan.
Bob's right about that. Shots were fired on January 9th. But since no further hostilities ensued immediately, April 12th is the date that is usually assigned to the beginning of the war. So given that date, did you know who fired the first shot at Fort Sumter?
Legend has it that privilege was given to an old soldier who was the leading advocate of secession in the area. He was 67 years old at the time and a native of Virginia. He was disappointed that his native state was not the first to secede. But when South Carolina did, in December of 1860, he was given a seat as guest of honor at the convention.
And when Lincoln ordered the supply ship back into the harbor, our ardent secessionist was given an honorary position as a gun captain and is credited with firing the first shot. Did you know that a military history journal gives that credit to Lieutenant Henry S. Farley? But most history of the time gives that honor to our gentleman.
All right. Who was he?
Our story isn't over yet. With someone as avid a Confederate as he was, can you imagine his disappointment when Lee surrendered?
Oh, how did he handle that?
On June 7, 1865, he went into his study and made one final journal entry. I here repeat and would willingly proclaim my unmitigated hatred to Yankee rule and to all political, social, and business connections with Yankees, and to the perfidious, malignant and vile Yankee race. And with that, he wrapped himself in the Confederate flag and shot himself.
His name was Edmund Ruffin. And with that, we can say, speaking of Fort Sumter, did you know who was the first casualty of Fort Sumter and thus the first casualty of the Civil War? It came about as a result of a gentleman's agreement between the opposing field commanders. It happened like this. The northern commander of Fort Sumter was Major Anderson, who had been artillery instructor at West Point. One of his students was P.G.T. Beauregard, now a general at Charleston.
Beauregard requested Anderson to surrender. When Anderson refused, Beauregard said that when the time of surrender did come, he would allow Anderson time to salute his colors before the surrender.
The shelling began at 4:30 a.m. on April 12th and continued for 34 hours. No casualties were sustained during this bombardment, but it became apparent that surrender was required.
True to his word, Beauregard allowed time for Anderson to fire a final salute to his flag. During this final tribute, one of the guns burst, and Private Donald Howe was killed by friendly fire. He would be the first of some 600,000. Who would die during the Civil War.
Our next person is not a future president. He is a general, and he had, well, what we might call health issues.
He was a hypochondriac.
That's one way of putting it, and he certainly had some unusual beliefs, one of which probably led to his death.
For instance, he often thought of himself as being out of balance. He believed that one arm was longer than the other, so even while engaged in battle, he would often raise one arm so the blood would run down and establish equilibrium.
He often sucked on lemons, believing they cured his dyspepsia.
What's that?
Indigestion. And even while on march, his staff knew he needed his raspberries, bread, and milk for medicinal purposes.
Well, remember what General Grant took a lot of, supposedly for medicinal purposes?
Never mind. The general's list of physical complaints was about as long as his arm. There was rheumatism, chilblains, neuralgia, biliousness, and distortion of the spine.
To rid himself of his nearsightedness, he dipped his head into a basin of cold water with his eyes wide open and left it there as long as he could hold his breath. He would also try to relieve all kinds of pain by applying ice-cold towels to his body.
But what was it that led to his death?
Here's the scene. It was Chancellorsville on May 2, 1863. After a day's fighting, the general and some of his staff rode out to size up the enemy's position. He left orders that if anyone were to come back on the road, the guards were to shoot.
The group ran into a Union guard station and raced back towards home. Whatever happened next, one thing was clear, and that was the general's orders were obeyed and he was shot three times.
To compound the problem, the poor general fell off the stretcher they were using to carry him to the doctor. When the doctor finally did see him, he had no choice but to amputate.
That still doesn't answer my question.
Remember the cold towels that the general used to wrap around his body? Well, after the surgery, the general's aides came in and, as was his custom, wrapped his body in cold towels. Pneumonia set in.
The general was Stonewall Jackson.
There's an old saying that anyone who tries to doctor himself has a fool for a patient.
Maybe instead of all the lemons, he should have had an apple a day. And talking about apples, when I was a kid, we used to grow some really big apples. We had to plant the trees sideways so the apples would lie there on the ground. And one apple would last you for the whole week.
If we're talking about big, I remember some mosquitoes back when I was younger. They were as big as buzzards and had nose suckers as big as soda straws. One day, they eyed me up one side and down the other. I was shivering in my boots. One said, "He wouldn't even make dinner for the two of us." "Not even a good dessert," added the other. "But the horse might do," and with that, drained that poor horse right down to the hooves in seconds. Then one said, "That was all right for an appetizer," and they looked at me again. One said, "Wait a minute. Let's rip the shoes off the horse, and I'll play you a game of horseshoes for him." If it weren't for the fact that they started arguing about whose shoe was closer to the stake, I'd never have gotten away. 10 miles down the road, and I could still hear them looking for me.
Well, I had some pretty big mosquitoes where I grew up, too. I saw this with my own eyes. We had this little park in our neighborhood, and one Saturday, this group of mosquitoes flew into the park with a grill, table, some fold-up chairs, and an ice chest. They fired up the grill, put the hamburgers and hot dogs on, laid out the buns and condiments, and put drinks on the table. Then they went around the neighborhood and invited the people out. That's how they hosted a barbecue.
How about some more bell ringers?
Did you know how some car companies chose their names? The Alfa Romeo. In 1910, the company started in Italy as Anonima Lombarda Fabbrica Automobile, Alfa. In 1915, it was bought by Nicola Romeo, who added his name to it, thus making Alfa Romeo.
The Kia. In Korean, it means rising from Asia.
Audi. In 1899, August Horsch started a car company. He called it Horsch. Not only his name, but in German, Horsch also meant hark. In 1909, he left that company and founded another one, which he also called hark. Only this time, he used the Latin word, Audi.
Another Latin influence, Volvo, which means I roll. In the beginning, they weren't referring to the car. Their first product was ball bearings.
Another Italian name, Fabbrica Italiana Automobile Torino. The car was made in Torino and became Fiat.
Humvee. This is an approximate pronunciation of HMMWV, which is the acronym of High Mobility Multipurpose Wheeled Vehicle.
And did you know Volkswagen, so-called the people's car?
And did you know that a duck's quack doesn't echo, and nobody knows why not?
Did you know that emus and kangaroos cannot walk backwards, and that's why they are on the Australian coat of arms?
Did you know that cats have over 100 vocal sounds? Dogs have only about 10.
Did you know that camel's milk won't curdle?
Did you know that all porcupines float in water?
Did you know that the only nation that begins with the letter A that doesn't end with the letter A is Afghanistan?
Did you know that non-dairy creamers are flammable?
Did you know that Murphy's oil is commonly used to wash elephants?
Did you know that karate originated in India before it spread to China and then Japan? It means open hand in Japanese and Tang Dynasty hand in Chinese.
Did you know that in the 1940s, the FCC assigned TV's Channel 1 to mobile services, but didn't bother renumbering the other channels? That's why the first TV sets started with Channel 2 instead of Channel 1.
Did you know that the words facetious, abstemious, and arsenious contain all 5 vowels in order?
Did you know that there is a 15-letter word that does not repeat a single letter? Uncopyrightable.
Did you know that Plymouth Rock weighs over 4 tons?
Did you know that coffee is technically a fruit juice?
Did you know that barn owls snore?
Did you know that in Sweden, 20% of all traffic accidents involve a moose?
Did you know the first movie to be shown in a drive-in was Wife Beware in 1933?
Did you know that if you visit Neptune, you better take plenty of sunblock? The summer is 40 years long.
Did you know that Baskin-Robbins created an ice cream flavor, Beetle Nut, for the first Beatles' first U.S. tour?
Did you know that the most requested song for the first dance at wedding receptions is Unforgettable by Nat King Cole?
Did you know that Smile by Nat King Cole was composed by Charlie Chaplin?
Before we get back to episodes where you try to guess who was that person, we have a story about a Civil War tragedy that you may have never heard. And if true, then you wouldn't have heard the names of any of those involved.
Why wouldn't we have heard of the tragedy?
I suppose it is because news stories become prioritized. If nothing is happening, a small event gets a lot of publicity. And if a lot of things are going on, then a fairly important occurrence could be left forgotten.
So in this case, on April 11, 1865, Lee surrenders to Grant.
Big news.
On April 14th, President Lincoln is assassinated.
More big news.
On April 26th, John Wilkes Booth is shot to death.
Still more big news.
On April 27th, a boat accident on the Mississippi River.
Not so big. So, let's get back to the big stories.
Unfortunately, the boating accident was fairly significant. The SS Sultana, under the command of J.C. Mason, had been contracted to bring released Union soldiers home. The Sultana had a crew of 85 and a passenger capacity of 376.
But every passenger comes with a fee for passage, and it pays to get the most out of a situation. So this day, the Sultana had an estimated 2,427 passengers, including over 1,800 former prisoners of war, many of them sick and injured.
On April 21st, the Sultana left New Orleans, headed for St. Louis. At Vicksburg, she stopped for some repairs. There was a soft spot on one of the boilers, but instead of replacing it, which would have taken 3 days, the captain elected a patch job, which was finished in 1 day.
The ship was so top-heavy that when she went around bends in the river, she would tilt from side to side. When this happened, water would run from one side of the ship's four boilers to another. Investigation later showed that the boilers were not completely filled, so when the ship tilted, some of the boilers were lacking water with fire still underneath. When the ship tilted the opposite direction, water would rush back against hot metal, causing steam and an increase in pressure.
On the morning of the 27th, about 9 miles north of Memphis, the boilers blew. The entire ship was soon engulfed in flames, and people were thrown overboard into the Mississippi. The official investigation cited listing caused by the overcrowding of the vessel, low water levels, and faulty repair on the boiler as the causes of the accident.
23 years later, Robert Loudon, a known Southern saboteur, claimed on his deathbed that he had used a cold torpedo to sink the Sultana, but most historians discount that in favor of an official explanation.
Wow! That puts the Sultana right up there with the Lusitania and the Titanic as U.S. naval disasters.
Even more so. 1,195 people were killed on the Lusitania, and 1,514 lost their lives aboard the Titanic. An estimated 1,800 died aboard the Sultana.
That made this less than big news story of April 27, 1865, the biggest naval disaster in U.S. history.
Did you know that the first Mississippi steamboat was the SS New Orleans, launched in 1811? During most of the golden years of steamboats, the boilers were made of inferior-grade iron plating. The ships were uninsured and unregulated and not inspected, so the passengers were pretty much on their own. Up to mid-19th century, there were some 4,000 fatalities with about 500 ships destroyed due to boiler explosions. Boiler inspections did not begin until 1852.
Now, a little more of our quiz. We refer back to an event that occurred in 1966. It was a casual remark made in an interview first published in England.
And the English didn't like it? and so rioted.
No, when it was first published in the UK in March, it caused no uproar at all. But when it was republished in the United States 6 months later...
Wait a minute. Are you saying that whatever was said caused no problem in England, but caused problems in the United States?
Big problems.
I don't believe that. We're much, much more cool and laid back than the British. Somebody must have told a lie about America.
What did they say?
There was an article written by Maureen Cleave about the lifestyle of the Beatles, and she quoted John Lennon as saying that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus.
Burn him at the stake!
Well, nobody tried to do that, but the Ku Klux Klan did lead anti-Beatles rallies and would nail some of their records to fiery crosses.
What would have caused Lennon to say something like that?
He wasn't the only one, Bob. It was a sign of the times. Since the end of the First World War, church attendance in England and other places as well was falling. People seemingly had tuned out.
The decline of Christianity was a subject of regular discussion, and the church itself was making no attempt at hiding the fact that they were trying to transform the image of Christianity.
The Reverend Ronald Gibbons once told reporters that a Fab Four version of O Come All Ye Faithful would give a shot in the arm to the Church of England.
And on the comedy circuit, comedians were having a field day with comments like, "Don't call me Vicar, call me Dick."
You know, I was in the seminary back in the early 60s, and there was a couple of books that were very, very popular. One was written by J.B. Phillips entitled, "Your God is Too Small." His concept was not a God up there, but a God out there. And another was written by the Anglican Bishop of Woolwich, John Robinson. It was entitled, "Honest to God." It was urging people to reject traditional church teachings on morality and the concept of God as an old man in the sky, and instead embrace a universal ethic of love.
So all of a sudden, Lennon's comments were not so outrageous.
Well, maybe not. Maybe he just shouldn't have said so out loud.
Even if they might have been true.
We know what we believe. We just don't have to live up to it all the time.
And now back to another former president. Our first item is that he was late in being informed of his election to the office of president, because the official notification came with postage due, and he refused to pay the postage, even if there was an official document inside.
He never voted in his own election. In fact, he never voted at all in any election until he was 62.
He rose to fame as a hero during the war with Mexico, and it was that status, rather than any political view, that catapulted him into the White House.
He was the last president to own slaves while in office, but his stance on slavery was distrusted by many Southerners, who were quite vitriolic about their displeasure with him. This led to the final curiosity of his life.
On July 4th of 1850, he was attending a groundbreaking ceremony in Washington, D.C., and someone passed him a bowl of cherries and milk. He got sick and died 5 days later.
Did somebody poison him because he wasn't enough pro-slavery?
Many thought that. However, the issue wasn't settled until 1991, when his relatives allowed an exhumation and tests were run by the Kentucky State Medical Examiner. The results showed there had been no poisoning. President Zachary Taylor had died of natural causes.
Our next president was the second president to be assassinated. On July 2nd of 1881, Charles Guiteau, who thought he had a bone to pick with the president because he hadn't received a consular appointment, shot the president at a Washington railroad station.
The president was taken for medical treatment, but the strange thing was that they couldn't find the bullet. Doctors searched and probed, and even Thomas Edison was brought in with his newly invented metal detector. Still, no success. Every time they passed the device over the president's body, the machine seemed to go haywire.
And if they could have found the bullet, they might have been able to save his life?
A distinct possibility, but they didn't. The president lived for over 2 months and finally died on September 19th. Responsible, mostly, was the infection caused by the undiscovered bullet.
Did they ever find it?
Yes, in the autopsy. And when they moved the president, they discovered that his bed was partially responsible for his death.
His bed?
That's right. His bed had metal springs in it, and that's what's made the metal detector just go crazy.
So, if there hadn't been metal springs in the bed, President James Garfield might have lived.
Never know. But the second assassination leads us to some thoughts about the so-called presidential or zero curse. As in many situations, the idea comes long after the fact, and the idea of this curse did not become popularized until 1931, when it was published in one of Ripley's Believe It or Not books.
The source goes back to the affairs of the Indians around the Ohio River, which culminated in the Battle of Tippecanoe. The curse supposedly predicted doom for any president elected in a year ending in zero.
So when Harrison was elected in 1840, the curse began. Harrison died a month after taking office.
Why not start the curse earlier with the president who ordered Harrison into the area? He didn't cause the problem. How did they know Harrison would even be the president in 1840?
Bob, you can't mess around with curses. Look what happens next. In 1860, Lincoln is elected and he is assassinated. Then in 1880, Garfield is elected and we just heard about him.
This all happened as a result of the treatment around the Ohio River in the early 1800s. What about the things that had happened between the early settlers and the Indians in the 1600s and 1700s? And what about the Trail of Tears? Nobody was concerned about that?
There you go again, completely off the subject. You can't ask a curse to rationalize itself. You just have to live with it.
Absolutely. And so it goes on to 1900 with William McKinley, 1920 Warren G. Harding, and 1940 with Franklin Roosevelt.
But McKinley was first elected in 1896. It was his second term. And FDR was elected in 1932. He was in his fourth term.
That's the kind of attitude that's just asking for a curse.
Don't be too hard on Impara. He's just new to how these things work. You don't rush prophecies, Bob.
Curses. Foiled again.
As it should be. In 1960, John Kennedy was elected, and he died in office.
Then what about 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected? He was wounded in an assassination attempt, but he lived through it.
Yes, but while governor of California, he refused to approve a major dam project that would have flooded an Indian reservation. His comment was, "We have already broken enough treaties with the Indians."
And that broke the curse?
Must have. Nothing happened following the 2000 election.
Bob, when it comes to legend and popular beliefs, you just have to remember that when historians describe the past, what people think happened is as important as what actually did happen.
So, if someone believes something, whether it's true or not, that makes it true?
Nicely put.
And now a few more bell ringers. Did you know that members of the U.S. Congress are the world's highest paid legislators in the world?
Did you know that once Winston Churchill had a heart attack in the White House while trying to open a bedroom window?
That every 20 minutes, the population of the planet increases by 3,500. During that same time period, one or more plant or animal species become extinct, approximately 27,000 per year.
That humans and giraffes have the same number of vertebrae in their necks, 7. They're just bigger in the giraffe.
That on March 29, 1848, it got so cold that Niagara Falls froze. For a couple of hours, you could actually walk along the riverbed.
That it takes 10 pounds of milk to make 1 pound of cheese, but it takes 21 pounds of milk to make 1 pound of butter.
That the last man to supposedly know everything there was to know at his time was Galileo.
That 2 wrongs don't make a right, but 3 sometimes do.
Okay, I think that's enough. Our next biography relates to another president. Well, not a president of the United States. The story begins back in 1835 when a young Army lieutenant fell in love with the daughter of General Zachary Taylor, Knox Taylor, age 16.
The old general knew well the rigors of military life and that the tolls that it put on a marriage, so he put his foot down and refused to allow the match. The young lieutenant's southern pride was ruffled, and he at first considered a challenge to a duel, but changed his mind and lit upon a different course of action.
He resigned his commission, and to escape the father-in-law's wrath, he took his young bride away to live on his ancestral plantation home on the Mississippi River. The new bride liked the life of a Southern aristocrat, and she managed the big house splendidly while her husband saw to the planting of his first cotton crop. Everything was coming up roses until
both husband and wife came down with swamp fever. Within 3 months, young Knox was dead. The grief-stricken husband went into seclusion for over a decade.
Then war broke out with Mexico. The gentleman came out of seclusion and took command of a volunteer regiment, the Mississippi Rifles. They marched off to do battle.
You'll never guess who his commanding officer was.
His former father-in-law, General Zachary Taylor?
Bob, you guessed it.
Did they get along?
Let's just say they gave each other a wide berth until the Battle of Buena Vista, when the young commander defeated the Mexican cavalry and saved the day for General Taylor.
When the dust had settled, the old general came up to the young man and quietly said, "Sir, my daughter was a better judge of men than I was."
And what happened then?
Zachary Taylor went on to become President of the United States.
And the young officer went on to become President of the Confederate States of America, Jefferson Davis.
I wonder what might have happened if she had lived.
Following the Civil War, a lot of rightfully bad things were said about Northern carpetbaggers who came south. Here's a story of a different kind of carpetbagger. After one of the early battles of the war, the dead and wounded were all over the area around Williamsburg, and the ladies of the town went out to see what they could do.
Kate Rowland came upon a badly injured young man from Maine. She knew he wasn't going to make it, so she just stayed close and tried to make him as comfortable as possible.
He made one request of her. He asked that she mark his grave, and then, after the war, notify his wife so she might be able to come and take his remains back to Maine so that they might be buried close to home.
When the time came, she fulfilled her promise and notified the wife, who duly arrived carrying a carpet bag. Kate then took the wife to the graveside, where they stood a moment, and then the wife said that she wanted to dig up the remains so that she could take them home.
She hired some nearby workers who carefully unearthed the coffin, opened it, and then, according to her wishes, removed the bones and placed them in her carpet bag.
Then she headed back to the train, placed the carpet bag by her seat, and headed back to Maine.
Kate watched one carpetbagger who came south with the very best of intentions.
Now we have a brilliant move by a past president that prevented some states' arguments. If you're interested in your state's history, you know in what order your state entered the Union, right?
Absolutely. North Carolina was the 12th state to become part of the United States. It happened November 21st, 1789.
And the first three states were Delaware, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey.
Good for you, Bob. But what about North and South Dakota?
I happen to have a reference book here, and I can look it up.
Which shows you it is not your home state. You're not quite as interested.
I've just visited Alaska and Hawaii. But I know they're in numbers 49 and 50.
But which one came first?
Easy. Para? Look that up as long as you've got the book out.
Point proved. Para?
Well, it says that North Dakota is number 39 and South Dakota is number 40.
And when were they admitted?
Let's see. They were admitted on the exact same day, November 2nd, 1889.
They are being listed in alphabetical order, but which one came first?
There's a footnote that says the results were intentionally shuffled so that nobody knows for sure.
Smart president. The situation. In the beginning, there was no North and South Dakota. There was only the Dakota Territory.
And there was a rivalry between the North and the South,
which was brought to a boiling point in 1883 when the capital was moved from Yankton to Bismarck.
Them sound like fighting words.
Indeed they do. And the Southerners responded by drawing a line between North and South and applying for a separate statehood.
And so they became a separate state.
Not yet. Congress turned down their request, which made the Southern residents even more determined.
The voters approved a new state constitution and elected a full slate of officers, including senators.
Now they were approved.
Nope. Turned down again. But tensions were getting so high that the federal government knew they were going to have to do something.
So, in 1889, the Dakota Territory was split in half and preparations were made to admit both states. But now the next rivalry begins. Who is going to be first?
Just like years ago, kids lined up at the bookstore. Who was going to be the first to buy the next Harry Potter book? So, who won?
Nobody knows. When the day came for the president's signatures, he placed each of them in a newspaper with just enough hanging out for him to sign. And then he shuffled them again and again until nobody knew which was which.
After he signed, he shuffled them again so nobody knew which one he had signed first. No basis for either state looking down their noses. Both admitted on the same day and no one knew which one came first. And who was that smart president?
Benjamin Harrison.
You know something? With all the shuffling around the president did so that no one knew which state was which, have you thought that maybe Mount Rushmore might actually be in North Dakota?
If you want the answer to that, all you have to do is walk around and look at the carvings of the presidents from the back side of the mountain.
Thanks.
We have one man of note who belongs to a more recent generation. He was born on January 20th, 1896, and lived to be 100 years old. In his later years, he was always dating much younger women. And when asked why, he said,
"Because all the women my age are dead."
He was also asked what concessions he had to make in old age. He replied,
"My cigar smoke rings aren't as big and round as they used to be. And in my martinis, I've cut down from 2 to 1 olive.
He was Nathan Birnbaum, better known as George Burns.
And how about a couple of word and phrase origins?
Okay, how about this? The world is my oyster. It comes from Shakespeare's The Merry Wives of Windsor. The character Falstaff is attempting to gain access to 2 family fortunes. He is accompanied by a loud braggart, Pistol, who wants to borrow some money. When Falstaff refuses, Pistol exclaims, "Why then, the world's mine oyster, which I, with sword, shall open." It means that he intends to take what he wants, when he wants, and by force, if necessary. While the phrase does not have the same dishonorable intents as did Pistol, it has the same boastfulness.
And to throw the book at, this has a totally American source. In the 1920s, following the enactment of Prohibition, many U.S. cities experienced a wave of violent crime. People got tired of it, and laws were passed to crack down on offenders, even to the point of sentencing 4-time repeat offenders to life sentences. Many judges searched for the maximum penalty to hand out to such criminals. In the underworld jargon, there was the warning to stay out of certain courtrooms because the judge would throw everything in the statute book at the criminal.
And to have a chip on one's shoulders. Believe it or not, this phrase actually started out as a game. In the 1800s in the United States, there was a game where one person challenged another to knock a piece of wood from their shoulder. Whether this was to be done with a hand or some other instrument, that is not known. However, the distance the piece of wood traveled was measured, and the greater distance was the winner. As the competition became more heated, the expression came to have a more combative meaning.
Jerky, dried or cured meat. This is an old one. It comes from the Quechua language spoken in the Andes. Their word was charqui, which meant dried flesh. Around 1500, the Spanish explorers borrowed it, and it became charqui. It then migrated to the Northern Americas and by 1840 became jerky.
And greenhorn, a beginner. This word goes back to the 15th century England and originally referred to a young ox who had immature or green horns. The horns weren't actually green in color, just not fully developed, like green fruit. Around 1650, it began to be used as a nickname for a young, recently enlisted soldier, and by the 1680s, it was being used for a novice in any field.
And how about the Stetson hat? Though famous as the hat to wear during one period in Texas history, the hat took its name from its creator, John Stetson, from Philadelphia.
How about match? This one may make you close your eyes and shake your head a little. Today, it means a little piece of wood or cardboard with a phosphorus head that we use to start a fire. But originally, it was the Greek word myxa, which meant a lamp wick. But it also meant mucus, because to the Greeks, an oily wick sticking out of the lamp's spout resembled a runny nose. Now, you can go, blech. The word finally became match in the 1300s. but the term wasn't applied to what we think of the match until 1831, a few years after its invention by an English chemist, John Walker.
Did you know that matches were also once called lucifers?
We have one last biography for you to guess. His reputation was as a rough-and-tumble frontiersman, and he was an adopted warrior of the Cherokee Nation, who became the first president of the Lone Star Republic.
Enter into the story the Reverend George Washington Baines, who, in 1850, was installed as pastor of the Independence Baptist Church.
Did you know that the Reverend Baines was the great-grandfather of Lyndon Baines Johnson?
And he happened to have as one of his congregation the wife of the rough-and-tumble frontiersman?
At the urging of the wife, the Reverend Baines had several long conversations with the old soldier concerning his spiritual welfare. At the conclusion of one of these sessions, he agreed to be baptized and joined the church.
When word got out that he had got religion, a lot of his old friends were skeptical, to say the least, and some were downright disrespectful.
So much so that on November 18th of 1854, the day of his baptism, pranksters filled the makeshift baptistry with tree limbs and other debris.
As in any campaign, when something unexpected occurs, improvise. The party was moved to Little Rocky Creek, and the baptism proceeded. As the recent convert came up sputtering from the water, he said,
Reverend, you baptized my pocketbook.
To which the Reverend Baines replied, Thank God. I wish it could have happened to the pocketbook of every Baptist.
Afterwards, a local newspaper published an article which stated that they weren't a bit surprised at the conversion. Some 3,000 clergymen had been praying for him because of his antics as a member of the U.S. Senate.
The man was Sam Houston, and when he was asked by the general public if it were true that his sins had been washed away, he responded,
Yes, that's true, and Lord help the fish.
Did he say that on purpose, or just for the halibut?
And did he make the comment over and over again, or just once, and then never repeated it to another soul?
Now that's a whale of a story.
It sure smelled like it.
And I've had it for today. This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and thank you for listening in to another edition of Did You Know?
This is Par Tolson. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience.
We would like to thank WRAL.com, a part of the Capital Broadcasting Company's Raleigh-based New Media Group, for their support.
If any of you might be able to help underwrite any of the programming of TRRS, please contact us at 919-832-5138.
And this is Bob Martin. Until next time,
goodbye.